hours. Oliver looked less than pleased, conflicted over the issue of Chad's pretense to gain access to the ghost. It didn't help that his uncle was sitting in a jail cell either. Sam drew him to one side. He may have misled you in the beginning, but it's clear he knows his stuff. Except that he lied. Water under the bridge. Remy, overhearing them, realized that Sam's practical approach might not be the best way to convince Oliver of anything right now. The poor man looked as though he'd aged 10 years in the last few days, stress etched in every line on his face. After his uncle's arrest and his near escape from the warehouse, he needed a softer touch. At the very least, some assurance that he wasn't going to be in the line of fire. She reached over, put her hand on his arm, smiling softly. And he is sorry. But when it comes right down to it, he was able to get the gray ghost up and running to your expectations. No one complained when he helped turn it into the showpiece it is, wouldn't you agree? Yes. Isn't that what counts in the end? If he lied about that, how do I know he's not involved in its theft? Sam, taking Remy's cue, said, "You really think he'd risk his mother's life?" He glanced toward Chad, who was pulling the fenders from the wall in order to disguise the Frankenrolls. "I don't know him personally, but my gut instinct is that he's the kind of person who takes pride in his work and wants to do the right thing. Getting over this latest hurdle will bring us that much closer to whoever's really behind the theft of the ghost." "Exactly," Remy said. "When we figure that out, we're that much closer to clearing your uncle." "You really think so?" "I do." "Not to mention," Sam added, "Chad will be an asset. Regardless of his fake pedigree, he knows what he's talking about. Still, if you want to back out, we won't stand in your way." Remy could see Oliver starting to waver. "The choice is yours. But we need him in our court." "Your uncle needs him in our court," Sam said. Oliver took a deep breath, then nodded, his gaze fixed on Chad and the car. "I trust your judgment. Let's do this." Chapter 32. The shop smelled of spray paint. Remy was putting the finishing touches on one of the fenders, which made Sam glad they were handling the drop-off out in the open where the smell wouldn't be an issue. Still, the most important aspect was the silhouette, and 2 hours later, he squinted his eyes, trying to imagine what it might be like if the sun was shining on them, pleased to see that the car's silhouette somewhat resembled the gray ghost. Close up was a completely different story. The spot welds on the new fenders were obvious, even with the gray spray paint covering them. The chromework had been buffed to a shine, the rust dabbed with paint, and the seat backs, both front and rear, now formed an arch similar to the gray ghost. Surprisingly, the leather and stuffing attached to the support with duct tape blended perfectly with the old upholstery. Unable to find a perfect color match, Remy had spray-painted the cracked leather and the duct tape holding it together a slightly darker blue. "One good thing," she said, tossing the empty spray can into the trash. "It doesn't look quite so worn now." Oliver looked up from the headlamp he'd been buffing. "Let's hope they don't notice the color difference." "If Remy's plan works," Sam told them, "it won't matter. They won't get that close." "How much longer?" Chad held up the blowtorch. "One last weld on the left front fender. But we need time to let the paint dry. If they touch the seats, we're done for." "Like I said, we don't plan on letting them get that close." "How are you going to keep them from seeing the car?" "We time it right," Remy said. "The sun will be angled directly behind it, blinding them." While Chad finished the welding, Remy went over what he needed each of them to do. Afterward, he looked at his watch. "Wrap it up. We need to get it loaded on the flatbed and put a top over it." Since their plan had changed, eliminating the need for a sharpshooter at the top of the hill, Sam and Remy flipped a coin to see who was going in the back way to get Chad's mom out. Remy lost the toss. "Is it wrong that I want to see their faces when they realize the car isn't the ghost?" "Hate to spoil your fun," Sam said, "but I'm hoping we're long gone before that happens." He rode with Chad, who drove the flatbed trailer, while Remy drove Oliver in their rental car, the four meeting up on the street near the park, where a few teenage boys were kicking a rugby ball around on the grass. Sam and Remy put in their Bluetooth earpieces, and he called her phone. Ready? She patted the gun holstered beneath her shirt, then eyed the ivy-covered wall. Where exactly is this gate? She asked Chad.
See where the boy in the yellow shirt's standing? Right behind him.
Got it. Can they see it from the inside? Only if they go digging through the ivy. Oliver, Sam said, you stay with the car. As soon as Remy comes out with Chad's mother, be ready.
I will be.
Sam and Chad walked back to the truck, Sam going over what he wanted Chad to say when he called the house. Remy and I will be in touch by phone the entire time. We need to get those two men out of that house and up the hill before that sun goes down.
You think it'll work?
There were so many variables why it wouldn't. But Sam wasn't about to mention any of them. The last thing he needed was to have Chad thinking about the possibility of failure. No doubt. They drove around the corner, Sam directing him to park, just out of sight. They waited a few minutes until the sun was slightly above and behind the truck before driving past the corner house, stopping so that the flatbed and covered faux ghost cast a long shadow onto the paved street. If everything worked as planned, anyone looking at them from the front of Chad's house would have a hard time seeing much else but the silhouette. Loosen up the tarp on your side and make the call. Whatever you do, we need to get both men out of the house so Remy can get to your mother.
What do I do if they see you?
Their attention's going to be on a car. I'll be inside the cab with the window open, watching over your shoulder. Don't forget, the sun'll be in their eyes. Chad got out, unclipped the tarp, pulled it off, stood in front of the driver's door, turned the speaker on his phone to low so that Sam could hear the call.
The gray ghost is here, he said when they answered.
Where? The only cars I see in front of your mother's house are ours.
Look up the hill.
Chapter 33. A moment later, a man walked out to the street, holding a cell phone to his ear with one hand, the other hand in his right jacket pocket, probably gripping a gun. He looked up the hill, squinting in the sunlight, then turned back toward the house.
Frank, get out here!
A second man walked out, Chad's mother at his side. He looked their direction, shielding his eyes with his left hand, saying something to the man on the phone, who said, "Bring the lorry closer." Sam tapped Chad on the shoulder as a reminder.
"No," Chad ordered. "Not until you send my mother into the house. After that, walk up the hill. The car's yours."
The man hesitated before saying, "You better not be trying something funny."
"I just want my mum safe."
The man said something to his partner, who in turn said something to Chad's mother. At first, she seemed reluctant to leave, but eventually she returned inside the house.
"Remy," Sam said softly, "she's on her way. I'm waiting for her."
When the woman closed the front door, the second man dropped his phone into his pocket and continued down the steps and into the street. They were about halfway up the hill when Remy said,
"Slight problem. She thinks Chad's on his way here. She won't leave without him."
"Great." Sam eyed the two men. In less than a minute, they'd be close enough to see they'd been duped. Worse yet, there were several children walking on the street. "We don't have a plan C," he told her. "Get her out of there before they're close enough to see the car."
"I'll try."
"What do I do?"
Chad asked Sam under his breath.
"Hand them the keys to the truck if you have to. We just need to buy Remy some time."
Sam watched as Chad, both hands held out, dangled the keys to the truck so they were visible. The two men stopped, one of them reaching for his gun.
"Who are you talking to?"
"I just want to get my mum," he called out. "The car's yours."
He tossed the keys at them.
"Get the keys, Bruno," the other said. "I'll call Colton and tell him we have the ghost."
Sam slipped out the door on the other side, working his way to the back of the truck.
"Sam?"
Remy's quiet voice sounded in his earpiece.
"So far, so good. Do whatever it takes to get his mother out of there. We've got her. We're on our way."
He peered beneath the faux ghost, watching as the two men strode up the hill. The man on the left, Bruno, stopped,
his eyes fixed on the car.
What the?
What's wrong? Frank said.
That's not the Grey Ghost.
Bruno drew his gun, about to turn back toward the house. Sam gripped his Smith & Wesson, running around the truck to Chad's side, aiming at the two men. No way was he going to let them anywhere near his wife. Finger on the trigger, he was starting to squeeze when he saw two girls at the bottom of the hill, playing hopscotch on the sidewalk, directly in the line of fire.
You ever play rugby, Chad? Sam asked, holstering his gun.
Yeah? Get ready.
He hopped up onto the flatbed trailer, picking up the tarp.
Hey, Bruno, he shouted. You forgot something.
The two gunmen turned and looked up at him. Sam heaved the tarp at Bruno, jumped, using the larger man's body to break his own fall. At the same time, Chad charged at the second man, lowering his shoulder, ramming him in the chest. They all hit the ground. The fall stunned Bruno. Sam grabbed him by his shoulders, pulled him up, slammed him back into the pavement, knocking the gun from his grasp. It fell to the blacktop a few inches away. Beside him, he saw Chad and the second man struggling, only then realizing they were fighting for control of the other gun. Chad had the weapon by the barrel, trying to push it away. He was losing. Bruno glanced over, saw what was happening, his eyes finding the fallen gun a mere foot away. No way could Sam get to it or his own holstered gun without letting him go. Bruno gave him a sneering smile.
Say goodbye to your friend.
Not likely, Sam said, driving his elbow into Bruno's face. He dove for the gun, fired at Chad's attacker, the ringing in his ears almost drowning out the other man's scream and the screech of tires of the flatbed truck that followed. Sam saw the flash of a knife blade from the corner of his eye. As Bruno rolled to his knees, lunging at him with the dagger, Remy jumped out of the car, gripping her SIG with both hands.
Drop it, she ordered.
Bruno, his knife only 6 inches from Sam's throat, eyed the almost 30-foot distance between them.
I've seen you shoot. You really think you can hit me from that far?
She fired. The knife flew from his hand, clattering down the street. Guess not, she said, moving closer. Bruno raised both hands, a look of respect and fear on his face. A few feet away, his partner writhed on the ground, gripping his arm, moaning. Chad had wrested the gun from him, his hand shaking as he backed away.
Are the police on their way? Sam asked Remy.
Any second now. She kept her focus on Bruno and his partner. Imagine running into our friends from Pebble Beach all the way out here.
Apparently they didn't get the word, Sam said, taking the other gun from Chad. We don't have the Grey Ghost.
He aimed the weapon at Bruno, about to ask who they were working for, when Chad's mother rushed out of the car, slapping at her son's hands as he tried to stop her.
Let go of me, Chad. What on earth has gotten into you?
Mum!
She stopped short at the sight of Sam and Remy standing over the two men.
Why are these two pointing guns at your mates?
They're not my mates, Mum. They're criminals.
Rubbish.
She stepped between Remy and the two thugs.
We had tea together. Put that thing down, young lady.
Mum!
Chad rushed forward, pulling his mother back. The gunmen, seeing a break, scrambled to their feet, racing down the hill. Remy aimed, following their path with her sight. It'd be an easy hit.
Let them go, Sam said, seeing the two little girls who had been playing hopscotch at the bottom of the street now standing there, staring at them, wondering what was going on. I have a feeling we'll get another chance.
Remy lowered her gun, but didn't holster it until both men had jumped into their cars, tires screeching as they drove off in the opposite direction. Once they were gone, she walked over, picked up the knife, turning it about in her hands.
Do you have to tease the bad guys? Sam asked as she returned to the car.
He had Oliver pop open the trunk so he could empty the recovered guns and store them.
It's fun.
For you, maybe. That knife was a lot closer to my head than yours.
Oh, buck up, Fargo, she said, holstering her gun. You'd have done the same.
So why didn't you?
He nodded toward the end of the street where the two little girls had come out of their state of shock, apparently, and were now racing back to their house.
Even Remy, an expert marksman, wouldn't have taken that shot.
The only thing behind her target was Chad's empty house.
She tossed the knife into the trunk, slammed the lid closed. Now that the fun's over, I suppose we should get out of here before someone really does call the police.
You call that fun? Oliver asked.
Chad's mother planted her hands on her hips.
Will someone please tell me what is going on?
Chapter 34. Mum, are you and Dad trying to steal from Uncle Albert? Allegra's heart clenched as she saw Trevor standing there holding the journal. She'd always known he was bright. She'd just hoped that he wouldn't figure out things so quickly. To make matters worse, Dex walked in, looking at the two of them, his gaze landing on what was in Trevor's hands. She tried to step between the two, but her ex snatched the journal and slammed it in the boy's face.
You want to accuse me of something? Then come talk to me instead of sniveling to your mother.
Dex swung the book back as if to strike him again.
Stop it, Allegra said, grabbing the journal from Dex.
I'm okay, Mum.
Trevor wouldn't even look at her. He reached up, touched his red cheek.
It's fine.
See,
Dex said, taking the book from her and tucking it beneath his arm. He pulled a bottle of ale from the refrigerator.
You coddle him too much. You promised you wouldn't hurt him, she said.
Dex glared at her.
Yeah? And you promised you'd keep him out of my business. That didn't happen, now did it?
How had this all gone so wrong? Obviously, she should never have answered the door when Dex suddenly appeared on her porch a few months ago, telling her he was a changed man. She'd foolishly believed his lies about wanting to build a relationship with their son, and she'd brushed off his absurd reasons why he was interested in the Grey Ghost and the Peyton family history. It wasn't until Dex came up with a story about being threatened by this Arthur Oren, insisting that if she called the police the man would kill him, that she began to question his motives. By the time she'd realized what was going on, why he'd spent the next few weeks pretending to be the perfect father to Trevor, it was too late. When she'd tried to put a stop to everything, Dex pointed out how happy Trevor was with him there. Wasn't she interested in securing the boy's future? All she needed to do was make sure that her uncle placed the Grey Ghost in that concho to help raise its value. Where was the harm in that? After all, her uncle needed to sell the car in order to save Peyton Manor. Foolishly, she'd believed him. Even after the car was stolen and her uncle arrested for murder, she hadn't quite realized the depth of Dex's involvement. After all, he was the one who brought her the papers to have Oliver sign over Peyton Manor so that they could hire the best solicitor. He'd been so helpful, so caring. Had it not been for the Fargo's timely arrival, Oliver would have gladly signed it. It wasn't until after the Fargo's hired another solicitor that she took the time to actually read the document that Dex had given her. Her bruises were still healing from when she'd confronted him with her suspicions about who was behind the theft of the ghost. That she could handle. It just never occurred to her that Dex would threaten to kill Trevor if she didn't continue to cooperate. That was all it took, and suddenly she was a blithering mess, getting in deeper and deeper as Dex ran his scam. Naively, she'd thought that if her son never knew what was going on, Dex would get what he came after, then leave. Just keep Trevor safe. She looked over at her son, who had opened the refrigerator, his back to them, taking an abnormally long time to search through the three items within. Somehow, she'd fix this. All she needed to do was get him out of the house.
Trevor, she said, I need you to leave. Go stay with one of your friends.
The boy stays here, Dex said. Now, she ordered in the voice she reserved for do it or else. You can come home when your father leaves. I'll be okay.
Trevor closed the fridge, turning toward her, the mark on his face still red. She saw the fright in his eyes and knew he didn't believe her. He'd seen some of her bruises. She didn't care.
Go!
Trevor started to edge away and was nearly out of the kitchen when Dex set his ale on the counter, pulled the gun, pointed it at her. Maybe I wasn't clear enough. The boy stays.
Trevor froze, his face paling. She couldn't have moved if she'd wanted to. Pulse pounding in her ears, she stared down the barrel of Dex's gun. He'd kept it hidden until now. Seconds ticked by as she frantically tried to think of what to do. Mum? The look in Trevor's eye, him realizing what sort of monster his father was, broke her heart. Her mind raced. The only reason she and Trevor were in this mess was because she'd wanted to keep him safe. She had to concentrate on that. Thinking about anything else was not an option. It's okay, she said, as calmly as she could manage. Your father's not going to hurt anyone. Are you? She said, trying her best to focus on Dex, not the weapon he held. He studied her for a moment, his eyes devoid of any emotion. That, more than anything, frightened her. Let me tell you how this is going to work, Dex said. We're going to spend the next week cozy on the couch. He used his gun to motion them toward the front room. When they both sat, he took the armchair. One of you will always be with me. If either of you tries anything, leaves, doesn't come back, I'll kill the one left. He gave a shrug, took a long sip of his ale. Not like I haven't done it before. Don't show fear, she told herself, willing Trevor to follow her lead. He was a smart boy, always had been. He'd learned long ago that the best way to keep his father calm was to not cry, not show fear, and not raise his voice. To do otherwise resulted in a beating. As promised, Dex refused to let either of them out of his sight at the same time. If she left the room, he held the gun on Trevor. And likewise, if Trevor left the room, the gun was turned on her. That night, the three of them slept in the same room, she and Trevor on the floor, Dex pulling the mattress up to the door so that neither of them could escape. The thing that frightened her the most was Dex's promise that if anyone attempted a rescue, he'd kill Trevor first and then himself, leaving her alive to suffer. There was no question in her mind that he meant every word, and so she dutifully did his bidding, knowing that her best hope was to cooperate and wait. She'd lost count of the time as the three sat in the front room, she and Trevor on the sofa pretending to watch the game, Dex in the armchair drinking a bottle of ale, still trying to read the journal. A knock at the door startled her, and she almost spilled her glass of water. She reached over, grasping Trevor's hand in hers, willing him to be silent. Chapter 35 Dex set the journal on the table, drew his gun, walked to the door, looked out the peephole. He looked back at her, putting his finger to his lips. A second knock, this time a man calling out, Allegra, I can hear the telly. I know you're in there. I'm not leaving until we talk. Dex, using his gun, motioned her over. She lowered her glass to the table, walked to the door. Find out what he wants, Dex whispered, and get rid of him. Who is it? She called through the door. Bill Snyder. I'm the private detective. I work for your uncle's solicitor. I have a couple of questions about your uncle's case. Would you mind coming back? I'm not feeling well. It'll only take a few minutes, if you can open the door. Allegra looked at Dex. It was several seconds before he responded, leaning in close, whispering, Try anything funny. Trevor's the first to go. She nodded, and he backed up, motioned for Trevor to precede him from the room down the hall into the office, closed the door behind them. Taking a deep breath, Allegra told herself it was completely reasonable that a private detective would come talk to her. Her uncle was in custody for murder, after all. When she opened the door, she remembered to smile. Mr. Snyder, how can I help? As much as she tried to block his view, he stood about a head taller than her. May I come in? I'd prefer you didn't. He looked past her into the front room. I take it your uncle's housekeeper rang. Mrs. Beckett? Perhaps when I wasn't home. Has something happened?
She mentioned that the last time you popped in, you took a book from the library. She thought it might be the missing journal that your brother was looking for. We think it might help with your uncle's case.
It took her a moment to process the man's words. The only thought going through her head was that Dex was in the office, holding a gun to her son. Focus. Breathe. Appear concerned. The journal? What does that book have to do with my uncle?
We're not sure, of course, but your brother seemed to think there were some entries in that particular volume that related to the stolen car.
What's in there was written over 100 years ago. Why would it be important?
That's what we hope to find out, and why Mrs. Beckett said she'd call ahead.
He stepped to the side, looking at something behind her.
Naturally, that's why I assume you have the journal there on the table. You knew I was coming by for it.
She realized that if she objected, it would bring even more attention to her possession of the book. Still, she needed to try.
I was hoping to keep it for a few days. I brought it home for my son to read. Ever since he went to live with my uncle, he's been fascinated with the Viscountcy.
I didn't realize anyone else lived at Peyton Manor but your uncle and Oliver.
This was a few years ago, back when my husband and I were getting our divorce. I just felt it was best.
I'm sure your son must have enjoyed his time there. It's a beautiful estate.
Trevor loved it there, she said, wishing she'd let him stay as he'd wanted, instead of forcing him to come home because of her misguided maternal notion to be near her son. What she needed now, though, was to get this man away from her house. The sooner the better.
You said you had a couple of questions. What are they?
The journal, of course. We'll need that for the investigation.
Dex would object, but there was little she could do. It was clear the man wasn't going to leave without it.
Is there anything else? She asked, retrieving the journal and handing it to him.
He slipped the small volume into the breast pocket of his suit.
Actually, yes. Your brother mentioned that there had been an offer on the estate. They thought you'd know who it was.
The name escapes me.
He thought it was some distant relative.
Something makes me think it was some cousin to one of the Viscounts generations ago.
Trying to hurry him along, she said, If you have a card, I'll give you a ring if I remember it. Right now, I'm too tired to think.
Of course, he said, reaching into his suit pocket. He pulled out a small gold case, slipping a card from it. Do you recall anyone ever coming around and asking questions about your uncle or the Grey Ghost before the car show? Or remember anyone at his house when you were there? Someone who didn't belong?
In fact, she did. Not that she was about to tell him. People asking about the car. Honestly, I paid little attention. Oliver handled all that.
What about here?
At my house? No, just me and my son.
You're the only two that live here?
Yes.
He's how old? The PI asked, finally handing her his business card.
16.
Is he home?
No, I'm here by myself. Why?
Just curious. I see the Toffees still have the game tied.
He nodded at the television when it was clear she had no idea what he was talking about.
Oh, right. I have it on more for background noise.
He gave a benign smile, thanked her for her help, then left. The moment she closed the door and turned the lock, Dex stepped out of the office, shoving Trevor in front of him, forcing the boy to the couch. Dex looked at the table, gave her an accusing glare as she took a seat next to her son.
You gave him the book? What was I supposed to do? He came here precisely because Mrs. Beckett saw me take it.
You were supposed to get rid of him.
I did. If you'd let me answer the house phone once in a while, I might have taken her call and been forewarned that she was sending him here. How was I supposed to know that's what he was after?
Not that we need it, he said, looking at Trevor. You seem to figure things out. Tell me what's in that journal.
When Trevor didn't answer, Dex pointed his gun at him. Slowly, she reached over, placing her hand on Trevor's, feeling his fingers trembling beneath hers. "Trev," she said, giving his hand a reassuring squeeze as she took a steadying breath. "Tell him what he wants to know. They found a boy who they thought might have seen the train robbery." "Keep talking," Dex said. "What else did you read?" Chapter 36. Journal of Jonathan Peyton, 5th Viscount Wellswick, 1906. I refused to think that my cousin Reginald was part of the train robbery, certain that the boy was mistaken, and that Isaac Bell's detective skills were lacking. And yet, there we were in his hotel with a child who insisted that my cousin was the very man who had killed the detective and the two train engineers. As much as I wanted to leave those premises, the only way to prove my cousin's innocence was to assist Mr. Bell in his investigation. Clinging to my certain belief, I was relieved when Bell suggested he must find a way to view the ledgers at the orphanage without drawing attention. "We need to create a distraction," Isaac said. "Get the headmaster's attention so that I can go in and examine the books." "I can help," came a small voice from the next room. Isaac and I looked over at the boy, Toby, who was now sitting up in the bed. He seemed to have a bit more color about his cheeks. I hoped from eating a good meal and not from any illness. "How?" Isaac asked. "I can show you how to get in." When Isaac turned his full attention to the boy, he added, "I've run away before, trying to find my mum. You can say you found me and were bringing me back." That's exactly what we did, but not before Isaac instructed Toby and me on what to say and do at our arrival, warning us that we had no way of knowing if the headmaster was involved. If he was part of the plot, we couldn't walk in and simply ask to see the books without arousing his suspicion. At the orphanage, we left Isaac to find the way in through the back while I took the boy through the front door, asking to see the headmaster. The gray-haired man didn't question Toby's running away, merely tousled the boy's head. "Off with you. To your lessons." His smile seemed forced. "Very kind of you to go out of your way to bring young—" He looked over at Toby as though suddenly forgetting his name, assuming he ever knew it. He cleared his throat and smiled. "Yes, well, we were quite worried when we discovered him gone." A loud thump came from the floor above us. The headmaster's eyes narrowed as he looked up at the ceiling. "If you'll excuse me." "I'd like to see the classroom," I said quickly. "Another time, perhaps." A second thump above us was even louder than the first. "I have work to do, and apparently, rats to ferret out." I froze. The truth was, I'd never stood up to anyone. Not my father, not Reginald, not anyone. But I pictured Isaac in the midst of burgling the office, his warning about the headmaster echoing in my head. When the man started to move past me, I stepped in front of him. I did not give you leave. Surprise, then suspicion clouded his eyes. "I doubt your father would approve of this intrusion." It was a tactic Reginald had often used, invoking my father's name. Even now my instinct was to back down, apologize, just as I'd always done, lest word get back. "Intrusion," I said, trying to sound offended, and though I knew I'd never be able to withstand the challenge should he decide to call my bluff, I added, "Shall we go fetch my father to ask?" The man's brows went up. Surprisingly, though, he turned and led me down the hall, opening the door to the classroom himself. There were at least 15 boys sitting at tables, listening to a woman who stood at the front of the room, reciting the alphabet as she wrote each letter on the chalkboard. Her brown hair, tied back with a black ribbon, fell to below her shoulders. When she turned to address the classroom and noticed us in the doorway, I was struck by her beauty. Her blue eyes met mine, and it was several seconds before I was able to move. I'd wished everyone else in the room gone so that I could talk with this vision uninterrupted, but any courage I'd mustered with the headmaster's help fled
as I looked upon her. I forced my eyes away, spying young Toby sitting at the back of the room, his attention on his writing slate. His presence reminded me of our mission, creating a distraction so that Isaac could gain access to the ledgers. I looked around the classroom, searching for something I could use as an excuse to capture the headmaster's attention, keeping him from his office. And then it struck me. "Madam, why are there no young ladies in this class?" The woman glanced at the headmaster, who suddenly remembered his place and made the introduction. "Forgive me, Mr. Peyton. May I present Miss Lydia Atwater?" She curtsied, and I gave a nod. "Miss Atwater, why are there no girls present?" I repeated. "A question I have asked since my first day here." I looked at the headmaster, waiting for an answer. "We find," he said, "that training the young girls to work in the kitchen and the scullery better prepares them for life outside the orphanage." Miss Atwater's chest rose, her cheeks turned a becoming shade of pink. But she said nothing. She didn't need to. I saw it in her eyes. Emboldened by her presence, I said, "The young ladies living here are not servants. They're children. I expect their presence in the classroom at once. And bring these children something to eat. How can they possibly learn if they're hungry?" He stared at me, aghast. "Perhaps you failed to hear my directive." "At once, sir." He hurried out the door. I was vaguely aware of the boys looking at me with a new admiration. But I only had eyes for Miss Atwater. I wanted to approach, to hold a simple conversation. But all the insecurities of my childhood and my father's domineering rule rushed back. "You'll forgive me for the interruption, Miss Atwater." She smiled. "You've done us a great service." I wanted to stand there forever. I wanted to ask her to walk with me, to accompany me somewhere, anywhere, even though I knew my father would disapprove of such a match. A viscount's son and a governess. He wouldn't stand for it. And I had never gone against his wishes. Aware that there were 15 pairs of eyes watching me, I bowed. "Miss Atwater." She gave a slight curtsy. "Sir." I wondered if I'd ever have the nerve to talk with her again. Tempted to turn back, I forced myself out the classroom door, stopping short when I saw my cousin striding down the hall toward me. His steps faltered when he saw me, a look of surprise on his face. "Peyton, old boy, what are you doing here?" Unable to think of a thing, I blocked his view into the classroom where young Toby sat, telling myself that I'd grown up with Reginald. My cousin was not a murderer. He couldn't be. When I looked back, I saw Miss Atwater continuing her lesson on the alphabet. Reginald followed the direction of my gaze, laughed. "I'd quite like to see your father's face when he discovers his dutiful son and heir has fallen for a common governess. You're likely to send him to an early grave." It occurred to me that I'd been given the perfect excuse for being there. I drew my cousin from the door. "You won't tell Father, will you?" "Your secret's safe with me." "I say, why are you here?" "Yeah, I left my gloves when we came by a few days ago to look over the ledgers. I thought I'd dash in and get them." He started past me. Worried that he'd discover Isaac's presence, then realize we suspected him of embezzlement, I blocked his way. A look of suspicion crossed Reginald's face, and I knew I needed to think of something fast. Chapter 37. On Sam and Remy's advice, Chad, still looking a bit shell-shocked after the rescue of his mother, convinced her and his aunt to visit the coast for several days. In the meantime, Chad's aunt invited them to stay at her home while she was gone. "I know your friend fixed my clogged drainpipe," she said to Chad as he carried her suitcase down the stairs for her. "But I really would like a plumber to have a proper look.
She smiled at Sam, who stood at the bottom of the stairs.
No offense, young man.
None taken. She gave a firm nod, turning her attention back to her nephew.
Please don't forget to water the garden. I don't want to lose my vegetables while I'm gone.
She reached over, tugging at the hem of his shirt.
And tuck this in. How do you expect to find a young woman if you look like that? Did my sister not teach you how to dress?
Chad looked slightly embarrassed as he guided her out the front door, where his mother sat in a waiting taxi. Once the women were safely off, he returned to the house.
You're sure they'll be safer?
He asked, watching out the window as the taxi departed. Definitely, Sam said, as Oliver's cell phone rang. The farther away from us, the better. At least until we figure out who's behind this. Oliver, who was seated at the kitchen table, answered, waved Sam over to him.
I'm not quite sure when we'll be returning to Manchester.
He pressed a button, set the phone on the table.
It's Bill Snyder, the private detective recommended by David Cook, he said.
Who's David Cook?
Chad asked.
His uncle's solicitor, Remy replied quietly.
You're on speaker, Mr. Snyder, Oliver said. The Fargos are here with me. I'll try to keep this brief, Bill said. I had a chat with your sister yesterday. She had the journal, after all. A bit reluctant to turn it over, but in the end she gave it to me.
The missing journal, Oliver said.
Quite. I took the liberty of reading a bit, to be sure. Young boy who witnessed a murder. American Detective Isaac Bell assisting the Viscount.
Good show, then.
Sam and Remy took the seat next to Oliver, asking, was there anything else you saw that would explain the sudden interest in the Grey Ghost?
Nothing that stands out in the few pages I read, Bill said. Unfortunately, time was an issue if I wanted to make the cutoff for shipping. I was under the impression that you wanted it sent to your researcher. She should get it tomorrow.
A shame, Oliver said. Thought we might have a go at it ourselves. See what turns up.
You're in luck, Bill said. My secretary scanned it. I'll have her send a digital copy to you first opportunity.
If you could send a copy to Remy as well, Sam said, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Peyton, Bill asked, I'll need your permission for that.
Absolutely. In fact, if you can copy the Fargos on all the correspondence, I'd be most grateful.
Very good. Something else you should be aware of, Mr. Peyton, Bill added. A bit of a feeling that your sister was hiding something.
She can be a bit strange. I wouldn't worry too much.
Maybe so. But the reason she gave me for having the journal in her possession seemed odd. It's possible the timing was mere coincidence. She mentioned taking it so that her son could read it.
Oliver leaned back in his chair, his expression softening.
Good lad, Trevor. Lived with us for a bit during her divorce. Stands to reason she'd think this. Can't tell you how many times I've told Allegra that the boy should read them. After all, unless I meet someone and start a family, which doesn't seem likely in my current state, he is the next in line for the Viscountcy.
Sam and Remy exchanged glances, Remy sharing a similar thought. The timing of Allegra taking that journal, in the midst of the investigation of her uncle's arrest for murder, was highly suspicious.
It could be coincidence, Sam said, more for Oliver's sake than any real belief that the detective's instincts were faulty.
Perhaps, Bill said. That, however, is only part of the picture. I was there mid-afternoon, one of those bright, sunny days, and her curtains were closed tight, and she was reluctant to let me in. Mind you, this last could be because she was by herself and there was a strange man at her door. But it was precisely because she said she was by herself that I found her behavior unusual.
For what reason? Remy asked. In her mind, someone with the years of investigative experience that Bill Snyder had was generally well qualified to make such an opinion.
The television was on. Football.
I made a comment about the score, and it was clear she had no idea what I was talking about.
Oliver laughed.
That part would be true. Allegra's never followed sports. There was also an open bottle of ale on the table.
Oliver's smile faded as he stared at the cell phone.
What is it? Sam asked him. I'm beginning to wonder if any of this has anything to do with my grandfather at all.
Her reprehensible ex-husband, Dex, suddenly appeared back in the picture a few months ago, trying to charm her. He's the sort that only comes around when he needs money. In fact, he's the reason Trevor came to live with us when they were divorcing. Define reprehensible, the detective said. Allegra never came out and said anything to me, and Trevor certainly never mentioned it. But we always suspected the man was physically abusive to her. If he's there, I'm not at all surprised that she'd try to hide it from you. She knows quite well what I think of her ex, and she'd worry that you'd tell me. That might explain it, Bill said. Sam wasn't ready to write off any possibility that someone else close to the family was involved. What's your gut instinct? Given that I'm reporting directly to her brother, Bill said, a past abusive relationship would certainly explain her behavior, especially if she doesn't want Oliver to know they're back together. Sad to say, this wouldn't be the first time I've seen this happen. When Remy reached over, casually placing her hand on top of Sam's, he knew immediately what she wanted. The concern etched on Oliver's face seemed to magnify in the few short minutes they'd been on the phone, as if the man needed more to worry about on top of his uncle's arrest. I know you have your hands full with this investigation, Sam said, but is there any chance we could impose on you to keep an eye on Allegra and Trevor? I wouldn't want to overstep my bounds, Mr. Fargo, Bill replied. So long as you're aware it may not have anything to do with Albert Payton's case. We're willing to pay the extra cost, Sam said. I think we'll all rest easier, knowing she and Trevor are safe. I'll see to it, Mr. Fargo. If there's nothing else, I'll get back to work. Oliver looked relieved once the call ended. I don't know how we're ever going to pay you back for all you've done. No need, Remy said. Your family. You'd do the same, I'm sure of it. Remy's right, Sam said, as his cell phone buzzed on the tabletop. Having your sister and Trevor looked after means we can concentrate on how best to help your uncle. He looked at the caller ID, surprised and a bit alarmed to see Selma making a video call, since, according to California time, it was just after 2 a.m. Nothing good ever happened at that hour.
Chapter 38. Is everything okay? Sam asked calmly, not wanting to alarm Remy. It wasn't all that long ago that someone had tried attacking them in their home at Goldfish Point, nearly destroying it in the process. Even though they'd recovered and rebuilt, turning their home into a near impregnable fortress, he still worried, and knew Remy did too. He could see it in her eyes as she waited for Selma to answer. Fine, Mr. Fargo, Selma said, her face filling the screen, as she peered at him over the tops of her dark-framed glasses. Laszlo was hovering in the background. Just another all-nighter. We were looking into the possibility that Isaac Bell was given the 4050. If so, there's no record that he shipped the car to America. If he sold it in England, we haven't found anything. It's also possible, Laszlo added, leaning into view of the screen, that he gave it away. Apparently he was extremely wealthy. Of course, Selma said, we're assuming the car he received from Rolls-Royce for his part in the recovery of the Grey Ghost is a 4050. Is there a possibility it was a different model? Oliver couldn't say for sure. Does it make a difference what car he was given? It could, Selma said. In retrospect, Oliver said, I assumed it was a 4050 because that was the car gifted to my family. It's highly possible that Rolls-Royce gave him a different car. Maybe a 30 HP, especially when you consider the 4050s were still in the prototype stage then. If we're lucky, it's in the journal, Sam said. You should be getting it tomorrow. They found it. At Allegra's. Selma's brows went up, but she kept her comments about that revelation to herself, merely saying, we'll have a look when it gets here. Not the reason for our call, however. You have our full attention, Remy said. During our research, we found a Rolls-Royce forum that mentioned an early model Silver Ghost about to be auctioned somewhere in Italy. The timing of when this rumor appeared fits in with the theft of the Grey Ghost. I'm hoping you've narrowed that down a bit, Sam said. That's a lot of country to cover. Unfortunately, no. Like I said, it's a rumor only, but enough of one that several people are talking about it. We thought it worth investigating. I sent an email to your friend Georgia Bakoven in case she's heard anything. Good thinking, Remy said. At one time, Georgia and her husband John traveled the globe photographing cars and writing articles for Sports Car Market. They'd long since retired to Italy, buying a villa and small winery in the hills near Chianti, which they turned into a bed and breakfast destination. Even so, they were still involved in the car world. Have you heard back from her? Just got the email, Selma said, which prompted my call. Mind you, according to Georgia, this is a friend of a friend of a friend. In other words, the reliability of the information is questionable. Noted, Sam said. What was the info? He apparently knows of a dealer in Italy who sells high-end jewelry and art. Usually recognizable names. Fabergé, Rembrandt, Bierstadt. But he's also brokered the occasional classic car. Fine art on wheels, Remy said, repeating what Sam had told her in Pebble Beach. An apt description, Laszlo replied. The rumor that comes into play, Selma continued, is the dealer's occasional foray into the rare stolen art. Georgia's working on it from her end, and we're working on it from ours. We're sure about this auction, Sam asked. If the rumor's true, it's this weekend. One of the many things we don't know is exactly which car. Sam thought about how long the ghost was missing. Long enough, perhaps, to make it to some secret auction to be sold? Can they really turn over a stolen car that fast? Remy asked. It's possible, Sam said. It's also possible, Selma added, that whoever stole it did so for that very purpose, to sell it. Quite right, Laszlo said. Done all the time in the underworld. Someone with enough money puts in an order and the broker facilitates the theft. The money paid is astronomical and the piece sold is usually never seen again. The point being, Selma continued, that the timing of this secret auction this weekend and the rumor of an early model 4050 coming on the market is worth looking into. If you do, Georgia wanted me to let you know that you're welcome to stay with her at the villa. Thanks for looking into that, Sam said. Anything else? Just wondering how your faux ghost trade for Chad's mother worked out. It was one of Remy's finest ideas. However, let's just say it wasn't our finest moment, Sam replied. Remy laughed. We almost needed rescuing from the woman we rescued. One good thing came out of it, Sam said. Now that she and her sister are safely off, there's nothing holding us back from doing a full-out search for the missing ghost. Dig up what you can on this broker. I think a trip to Italy's in order. I'd like to take a closer look at him. He looked over at Oliver and Chad. We can certainly use your help if you'd like to come with us. Oliver's eyes widened at the suggestion. You can't seriously think that someone who's dealing in stolen goods is going to let you just walk in and demand to see the car, do you? Maybe not. But if someone there knows where the ghost is, we're certainly not going to wait for an invitation. Chapter 39 Remy, absorbed in reading the journal entry on her tablet, barely noticed the 2.5-hour flight until they started their descent into Ciampino Airport. Outside, the blacktop of the tarmac rippled with heat waves, the summer sun beating down as the Fargo's jet landed, taxied toward the hangar they'd rented for their stay. By the time Sam, Remy, Oliver, and Chad cleared customs and immigration, then picked up the rental car, the four were grateful for the air conditioning in the car during the 2 hours it took to drive to the villa. Remy eyed the acres of vineyards and the long winding drive shaded on both sides by tall sycamore trees. At the top of the hill, a wide wrought iron gate blocking their passage now swung open. Georgia, a tall woman with short dark hair wearing a flowing white linen dress, stepped out onto the terracotta-tiled porch as they got out of the car. Remy, darling, so good to see you. She gave Remy a kiss on each cheek and turned to Sam. Handsome as ever,
Georgia, Sam said, as beautiful as the day we first met. I swear you don't age. You're such a wonderful liar. She smiled as Sam introduced her to Chad and Oliver.
The Viscount's nephew, she said, shaking Oliver's hand. Did I understand that you and Sam are actually related?
Cousins, Oliver replied. Georgia turned with amused expression in Sam's direction.
Had I only known, I'd have thrown a very large party.
Cousins, Sam said, several times removed.
Don't let him fool you, Georgia, Remy said. Sam's only 500th or so in line to the throne.
Georgia laughed as she beckoned them inside. No living with you now, is there, Sam?
Trying not to let it go to my head.
He looked past her into the house.
Where's John?
Winemaking. Never-ending job. He should be up in a little while.
They stepped into the cool interior, the same terracotta tiles from the porch on the floor inside. Georgia showed them to their rooms, pausing as she was about to leave.
Had I known earlier you were coming, I'd have canceled the group renting the villa this weekend and you wouldn't have to rush out.
We'll be fine, Remy said. Georgia smiled.
I'm not sure I will. College students on summer break. One of my friends rented to them last year, but he was booked up. Apparently, they're loud but very respectful. The one advantage is they all sleep in late. The mornings are quiet.
She led them upstairs. If you need help finding a place after this weekend, I have other friends who've joined the Bed and Breakfast Club. I can find you a lovely place to stay.
If we're lucky, we'll find what we need in a day or two.
George's face clouded with anxiety.
I don't suppose there's any way I can convince the four of you to give up this search. I've heard this dealer can be dangerous. There are rumors that he's connected to the Mafia.
We at least have to look into it, Sam said. Her smile was grim.
I do hope you'll change your mind. Even so, I'm glad we'll have a chance to catch up.
You haven't made dinner plans, have you?
None.
Then I'll see you after you have a chance to freshen up. We'll dine on the veranda around 8. I'm looking forward to having you try our Chianti with dinner.
Remy joined Georgia before the men returned from their tour of the wine cellars beneath the house, hoping for a chance to catch up with her friend. The veranda overlooked the vineyards they'd seen on the drive up, the evening sun painting the rolling hills with a golden glow. A light breeze rippled through the vines, rustling the broad leaves.
Remy sighed. It must be wonderful looking out at this each night. I'm a bit envious.
Don't be. We're actually considering selling.
Why? Well, I thought you loved it here.
What's not to love?
Unfortunately, while it was one of those ideas that look good on paper, the reality is that running a boutique winery isn't nearly as profitable as we'd hoped. Hence, the bed and breakfast angle.
Remy looked over at Georgia, noting the worried look in her eyes.
If you need help with anything, you'll let us know.
Georgia gave a slight shrug, smiled. There are worse things than being poor. Like not seeing a good friend in years and years.
Come, sit.
She led Remy to a glass-topped table with several wicker chairs set around it. She opened a bottle of Prosecco that had been chilling in an ice bucket, poured two glasses.
Now, tell me all about this car you're hunting for.
How very exciting it all sounds.
Frustrating is more like it, Remy said.
That car was practically stolen from right beneath our noses.
Selma mentioned that.
And no idea who took it.
Not yet.
I don't suppose you've heard back from this mysterious friend about the secret auction.
Another auction actually came up. This one in Milan, though I'm not sure it's at all the one you're looking for.
Someone had the bright idea of combining cars with fashion and selling high-priced tickets.
What makes this a possibility is that a late entry is creating a lot of buzz. A Rolls not previously seen on the market. But it's specified as an early model, not an '06 or '07.
I have two press passes that will get you in the door for an up-close look at the cars.
When is it?
This weekend, Georgia said. I still haven't heard back on the other one. It's by invitation only.
Very private. No tickets, no press.
Also a Rolls.
Near Rome, though.
No year?
Early 40-50 is what I heard.
She leaned back against the flowered cushions, the wicker squeaking beneath her weight.
As I mentioned to Selma, the person I'm waiting to hear from is a friend of a friend of a friend. Maybe not even that close. I'm talking to someone who is intermediating, I suppose you could say. All very hush-hush.